Today we speak with acclaimed author and activist and San Francisco legend, Chris Carlson, about his new novel, When Shells Crumble. The novel begins in December 2024, when the U.S. Supreme Court nullifies the popular vote in the presidential election and awards the presidency to an authoritarian Republican who proceeds to demolish democracy and install a fascistic state that hastens ecological havoc. The novel is much more than your usual dystopian tale. It focuses on how to resist political cynicism and defeatism and rebuild on planetary wreckage. It is a world-building project filled with wisdom, sadness, and joy. We specifically put this fictional text in conversation with Carlson's brilliant nonfiction work, Nowtopia, which offers a radical redefinition of work that restores dignity and value to their proper places. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. So the first question, obviously, what inspired you to write this novel? I was looking at your bio and I saw that you published a novel after The Deluge, which was published in 2004. So here we are two decades later.
Yeah. In fact, this book, When Shells Crumble, the new novel that came out just at the end of last year, was originally set out to be the prequel. And after I finished After the Deluge, I realized I had a trilogy in mind, and this was the prequel, and I obviously sat on it for almost two decades. And as I wrote this new novel, I realized that it's only marginally a prequel because it's too far apart in time. The other novel was set 150 years in the future. It was a green city utopia. San Francisco has generalized abundance. There's no markets. There's no money. There's basically elevated wooden bikeways crisscrossing the city. There's wild corridors, restored creeks and lagoons. The oceans have come up 12 feet. There's gondolas everywhere that are weird bio boats. There's all this biotech in that book because part of the vision that I had when I was writing that 20 years ago was that, like it or not, and I'm one of the knots, there's a ton of capital flowing into biotech and all of its various myriad forms. I thought, play that out. Even if we have a big revolution and some decades from now, there will be all this biotech in place. And actually my vision somewhat speaks to the current novel as well. When we think about the natural or quote unquote natural, really unnatural ebb and flow of capitalist crisis and the inevitability of, unfortunately, war and depression on our horizon as a way to destroy lots of capital to reset the terms of capital accumulation for the next round, assuming capital comes out of the other end of it, which let's hope not, but we've hoped a long time for that not to happen, and it keeps happening. My guess, my best sort of personal theory of the near future is that the next round of accumulation will be based on a biologically founded system of capital accumulation, and a lot of technological shift will move away from fossil fuels and away from metal and heavy materials that require so much depredation of the earth and towards some sort of biological system so that then they can wrap themselves in the mantle. We're green. We're great. Capital's fine. It's not the problem. It's just now that we're green, everybody can be happy again. And I can easily imagine some version of that having a brief moment of success in, on capitalist terms. And once we've solved the problem of stupidity of wage labor and the organization of life as we know it, we'll be left with whatever the technosphere is that got created. And so that was the vision of that future novel. And so this new one really sets that in motion. But I made some assumptions on the beginning of this novel was that there's already a giant biotech firm called Biogenma.
Exactly. Yeah,
it's a little bit like the Google of biotech. That doesn't really exist. There's companies out there, but none of them really have that level of preponderance, and certainly not in the consumer market. So this company has a mythical product that I invented called, and this IntelliGel is produced by essentially urban peasants who are given a deal where they get a free apartment and a $5,000 bonus if they agree to live in a place where they are have to spend most of their time, most of their days, tending these little trays of seedlings in their windowsill that are fully technologized with wires and whatnot and special inputs and all this stuff. And every day they tend these are called Prosper plants with a registered trademark on Prosper. And they're essentially under the thumb of the company, Biogenma. Anything goes wrong, anything doesn't go, they don't produce enough of the plant at the end of the 10-month cycle, they just get rid of them and they leave. And they have already signed a contract that says, yes, they'll vacate their apartment in 3 days. And under the terms of this special, it's almost like this current fantasy this local tech horrifying guy has about building these zones for the grays, the fascists of the tech world that are going to take over whole chunks of the city by buying it and then excluding everybody who doesn't agree with them and making them wear special uniforms. And so there's a little bit of that premonitorily in my novel, but not fully developed. But these apartment buildings, anyway, belong to BioGenmo. So then there's this movement called the Urban Peasants Alliance, the UPA. And that's one of the sort of social movement characters that I invent out of whole cloth. And I found myself having to do that because I've been so dismayed at the absence of proper social movements in our era. There are obviously the work you've been doing around Gaza and the uprising that's going on across the world to really try to put a halt to the genocide as soon as possible is a good example of how it's always there. It's just below the surface, the possibility of major social movements emerging and up and really altering the course of events. Sometimes they emerge and don't alter the course of events really very much at all. So that's part of the frustration is we don't know how to gain the leverage we need to really.
Exactly.
So for a long time, as back in the early days of my life, I was involved with Processed World Magazine. I was one of the founders. And that magazine was founded on the notion that what we do, our work, produces this world. And most of the work we do is a waste of time. We should just stop tomorrow and we'd be better off for it, not just individually by changing my job, but actually socially, we need to change the aggregate division of labor. And how would you do that? The only possibility of that is for people who actually go to work every day to stop doing it and do something else.
Yep.
And so I've been advocating for that since I was 23 or even earlier. And now I'm 67 and it hasn't gained a lot of traction, to say the least. So in my novel, then I try to find people who are in motion at the workplace, in places of employment where they are beginning to challenge the direction of events. And we see some incipient versions of that with the tech workers coalitions and alliances and the Google workers protesting some of the military production. All that's, I find that hopeful for sure. But in the novel, the Urban Peasants Alliance are the people that have been thrown out. And so there's one sort of social movement. And another one is the League of Urban Farmers. Mm-hmm. And then they have a canopy council, which is like the coordinators for each part of the city that helps figure out how to produce more food in urban spaces. And those are two of the social movements that are in place as the book begins, as you start in. But then the drama that rips you from the first pages is the fact that the Republicans steal the next election through predictable fraud at the level of state legislatures and Supreme Court. And so people are in motion then in San Francisco, for whatever that's worth, protesting it. But it turns out it's happening all over the country. And so the new government comes in, and I just ignore Trump and Biden. They're not part of the picture. Biden dies and should have died in February, according to my novel of this year. And then the new president is Asa Hutchinson, who did run. That's hilarious when I put it in my book as a presidential candidate. And then he wasn't even running at that point. And then he started running. Going, oh, my God, my book's going to
exactly. Come. Yeah. The name sounded familiar.
Yeah. And then I gave him a vice presidential choice of Susana Martinez, who was the Republican governor of New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Some time ago, and that they run on a new day for citizenship, just what you'd expect out of a bunch of mealy mouthed politicians to say that they're going to do something good for Latinos and immigrants who are actually the opposite of that. There's two key states, Wisconsin and Arizona, where the state legislatures throw out lots of votes in Arizona and cause the tide to tip towards Republican. And in Wisconsin, they just invalidate the whole vote, give it to the Republican. And the U.S. Supreme Court upholds that using the same doctrine they threw out last year, sort of preemptive state legislative control over elections inside of states. And so that sets off this frenzy of protests all over the country and riots in the streets. And lots of protests is happening everywhere, including from the right, who are trying to back this up, their force and strength. And so you have really mass violence in many places. And in the Bay Area, and every one of these big regions that has this happen, there's a czar appointed, a homeland security general who becomes the de facto governor of the territory. And in the Bay Area, they create a zone at the Hayward Executive Airport that becomes kind of green zone. And so people are forced to report there to serve for the new Homeland Security Forces. And one of my main characters, who's part of this sprawling black family that's been living in San Francisco since World War II, is Frank Robertson. And he's the youngest of the family, but he's already in his 60s and he's near retirement as a cop. And then he ends up joining UCSF, University of California Police Department. He just drives around in a car all day in Mission Bay. It's a super cushy EV sinecure type job where all he has to do is rouse people with shopping carts from entering the zone. Not a pleasant job. So that's Frank. And he gets impressed into service. He suddenly finds himself put into the forces of Homeland Security.
A couple of things. One is you seem absolutely prescient. I'm thinking here I'm at Stanford and there's a famous, what's called the Dish Walk. It's up on the hill.
My wife is a Stanford alumni, so I've taken that walk.
So you're up there, and I've been here 32 years. We used to look down just all these engineering, just computer sciences and that. And then gradually, but decisively, all the hospital, all the biotech stuff has become the hegemon. Yeah. And it's really, we are going to give you the keys to immortality. This is exactly what you're talking about. And our former disgraced president on the board of Genentech. So you nailed it, man. It's so prescient and so real. And what's the quality of life? That's a completely vacated question. It's just the sheer existence is all that counts. And it taps into the whole sustainability mantra, right? We just want to sustain what? Capitalism, of course. Just keep this engine going. And as you say, keep the pattern of you expend energy tightly constrained into this one formula. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And I'm definitely going to read this novel. Would you change anything from that after the deluge, knowing now what you know? Or would you basically say, no, I had it spot on then and don't screw with it?
After the Deluge is like whimsically imaginative because it's set in this world that's 75 years after a great die-off.
Die-off
that I put in that novel had to do with some rogue biotech lab in Texas that something escapes from, and it ends up killing everybody that doesn't have THC in their bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All my pothead friends were like, oh my God, that's it. We're gonna
exactly. Finally, some good news, right?
Exactly. And I was a little bit more of a pothead when I was writing that book. I gave up pot a little while ago because I just don't, it's too strong now. It's not the same.
Exactly.
But I was very involved with that for most of my life as one of my economic activities. I think the main thing I'd have to change is I think the oceans are going to come up higher than I had in that book. I predicted in that book 12 feet when I wrote it in 2003 and 4, or 2 and 3. And 12 feet doesn't seem like enough anymore. It's all going so much faster. I saw Kim Stanley Robinson give a talk when he was two-thirds of the way through his climate change trilogy. And he comes out in front of the crowd and he stands there and just stares at us for 60 seconds and doesn't say a word. And finally, he says, ice melts a lot faster than we knew. Then he went on like things he'd put in his book were already happening. Things that he was predicting for 40 years in the future.
Exactly.
For all things that drama. So that's the one thing I would definitely change in that book. But I think the rest of it, I would just leave it alone. There's certain things you think about a first novel and a different part of my life. There's things I put in there that I might feel embarrassed about a little bit. Cardboardish moments and characters or dialogues or whatever that could be obviously improved. Same with this book. Any book you write, you can look at it later.
Exactly.
I could have been a lot better, but I'm famously a person who's, I get a lot of stuff done. I have 10 books in print and I run this huge sprawling history site with 2,300 screens of content and ever growing and so on.
Wow.
I'm always able to do all this while I have this incredibly comfortable life. I don't work very hard. One of my many fake organizations that I've been part of and running and founding for so many years now is the Committee for Full Enjoyment, not Full Employment.
No, I think especially as one gets older, you realize that you have less time, but you create more time. Maybe there's more time there. And I would love to have you read something. But before you do, I wanted to, as again, part of my appreciation of your work, we're roughly the same generation. And I grew up in the Bay Area. And I see in the latest novel so much of a kind of looking backwards at what happened in the 60s and the 70s and the things that were so hopeful and then got driven underground in the horrible 80s and 90s. But that seemed to be bearing fruit again. But I think what you're not up brilliantly is that it's not nostalgic in a kind of sentimental way, but it brings the positive sentiments out, but tests them politically. Like, what will actually work in this new landscape that we're facing today? And what's the status of things like communalism or the environment or the human body, And you really are so shrewd at not accepting things whole cloth, but rather seeing what will actually work and having your characters go through all this themselves. And these wonderful combination of characters playing off each other, almost being different voices of hope or cynicism that I appreciated so much. And the fact also that you bring in non-human life in a really capacious way. So I just wanted to put that out there because it's a long novel, but I think it had to be because it has all those ambitions there. Could you read us just one passage just to start things off, maybe?
Sure. Yeah. This is very early in the book. And this is when Frank, my police officer, youngest of a large clan, is actually his niece, Janet, who's the urban farmer, who's another major protagonist in the book. Janet Pierce is her name, but she's the niece of Frank. So they have some overlap here and there throughout the story. And they obviously are in the same San Francisco and large family. There is a family tree at the beginning of the book that shows you the sort of the range of all this. And that just goes back to my historian hat, where I'm really fascinated by the way people arrive in San Francisco and how they develop life here, and particularly Black San Francisco, because before I read my excerpt, I want to give you a tiny digression, which is that I grew up in Oakland and before that in the south side of Chicago. So I always have this sense like I was adjacent to and immersed in Black America as a child. And once I reached college age and I moved away from home and went to college, which I went to Sonoma State at first, I entered white world, which I had never been in. It was just a weird experience to be completely immersed in white world after being in a very integrated life, even growing up with the Temptations and James Brown and I'm Black and I'm Proud as being the major tonic environment. And so I arrived in San Francisco after several years in the Sonoma County and traveling on the first day of 1978. And I landed in the Haight-Ashbury when it was still 50% Black. And the lower Haight, which is what we call it today, was the Fillmore District. And the Fillmore District was 100% Black, really going back to the mid-50s and onwards, starting at World War II and continuing. There's always been everything in San Francisco integrated to some extent, but there's also like preponderant population groups. But like Page Street from the park all the way to Market Street was Black owned when I arrived in 1978. And that changed really rapidly over the next short few years. So I basically always feel a sense of loss for the diminishment of Black San Francisco. I personally experience that as loss. I'm unhappy about it. And my own quality of life has been diminished because of it. So I that's something I want to emphasize. But anyway, so here's Frank. This is a family that the parents arrived, as many did during World War II, to work in the shipyards. They hooked up, realized they get better housing if they get married. So they were having a relationship and then they got married. They ended up having six children. And Frank's the youngest of their children. He's now in his 60s. So here we go. And he's leaving his girlfriend Sheila's place. Frank left Sheila's and went home to the house he shared with his mother on Marlin Street in Hunters Point. Throwing his extra uniform and changes of clothes into a duffel bag, he organized his toiletries and got ready to go. "Moms, they're sending us to Hayward," he loudly announced to his 100-year-old, increasingly deaf mother. He explained about the mobilization order following the declaration of a national emergency. She was watching TV, where she had seen the basics already. "Who is this new president? What is going on? I've never heard of anything like this before." Frank tried to explain. "The Republicans seized the government and they were using force to protect it." He didn't want to help them, but he couldn't see how he could refuse to go. His entire department had been ordered to appear. His mother was worried, of course, but he reassured her as best he could. "I'll be fine, Moms. Nothing's going to happen around here." He hoped he was right. The door swung open and in walked Leon, his son. Frank always saw his own face in Leon's, though his son was several inches taller, darker, and much thinner. "Frank, what the hell's going on?" Frank grimaced as he continued organizing his belongings. "I've been mobilized. They're sending me to the new Homeland Security base in Hayward." "How the hell does that work? You're a UCSF cop. You don't work for the feds. Why do you have to go?" Leon was exasperated. Frank turned to his son, soon to turn 30 years old, and suddenly saw him in a new light. He was a successful businessman, having taken on a share of the cannabis empire from large Larry Lansing years ago. "Leon, it's complicated. I don't want to go, but I've been ordered to appear. They've issued a regional emergency declaration, so that means everyone has to follow the orders of the authorities or be arrested. It's hard to believe, I know. I can hardly believe it myself." His voice trailed off softly. He was in shock. His police training, with its militarized deference to authority, was running on autopilot, and he didn't see any other course of action. "Frank," Leon could see his father faltering a bit. You could resign, couldn't you? Why don't you just stay here and call in sick at least? Too late for that, Frank sighed. I'm not hiding either. I'll go and see what's happening. Maybe it'll be better if I'm there. Recalling times he'd been able to cool things down as a street cop and later during his patrols on the campus. Leon looked down at his chirping phone. Janet's texting me. She's asking about you, Frank. Tell her I'm fine. I'll call you guys later. Frank kissed his mother goodbye, grabbed his bag, and left. You look after Granny, okay? He called over his shoulder to Leon. Yeah, of course, he replied. Granny, how are you doing? He asked in a loud voice. Oh, okay, she smiled at her grandson. You gonna stay here for a while? I gotta go now, but I'll come back tonight and bring dinner. Leon headed out the door and found Frank sitting in his car texting on his phone. You sure about this, Frank? Leon asked him again. Frank looked up. Sheila's at work. They're swamped with getting new buildings and materials for the big camp they're building in Hayward, he reported. This looks worse than I thought. And he anxiously backed up while giving a small wave to Leon. Before long, he was rolling over the Bay Bridge and then down the Nimitz Freeway towards Hayward. Listening to the radio didn't help. It was filled with official bulletins and news flashes about riots in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Seattle, Washington, Baltimore, and Philadelphia. In Cincinnati, protesters were shot by a vigilante mob who were occupying City Hall and declared themselves a legitimate government. Reports of white mobs attacking protesters were coming in from dozens of cities in the Midwest and South. In the big cities, National Guard call-ups were being used to end the riots. Shit, is this the new civil war? Frank said out loud, shocked at the chaos coming over the radio. He exited the freeway amid a steady stream of white Hummers and personnel carriers with ICE logos and Homeland Security stenciled on them. Hundreds of other police officers were also driving in from around the Bay Area. He parked at the Southland Mall and followed the signs for new arrivals, police. At an empty store on the second floor of the mall, next to a virtual reality playground on one side and a footlocker on the other, he got in line behind a half dozen others. Man, this is weird, said the woman behind him. He turned to see who had spoken and found a stocky Latinx woman in a Berkeley police uniform. No shit. What do you think they've got planned? Frank asked. You a cop? She queried him. He realized he was in plain clothes, and since he hadn't shaved that morning, he probably didn't look too sharp. Oh, yeah, UCSF Police Department. I got the call rather suddenly this morning, long before my shift was started. She relaxed a bit and gave him a tight smile. Okay, yeah, I have no idea what they think they're doing. How many did they call from your department? They requisitioned about one-third of the Berkeley Police Department. No idea. I think it was a third of us, too. Nobody explained anything to me. They gave me orders to get here by noon. It was Frank's turn at the registration table. ID and badge, please. ID and badge, please. He pulled out his wallet and his badge and handed them over. The Homeland Security uniform clerk filled in fields on the computer and asked Frank, do you understand what's happening, sir? No. You are being drafted into a Homeland Security strike force. You will be serving for 6 months with possible extensions lasting up to a maximum of 18 additional months. The most you'll have to serve will be 2 years. 2 years? Wait a minute. I'm supposed to be retiring next year. I'm sorry, sir. There's no provision for that. Our retirement age is 75 now, as President Hutchinson decreed last week. Social Security, pensions, and retirement are delayed until 75.
What?
How come I haven't heard anything about that, sputtered Frank. This is outrageous. Sir, please calm down. The printer began whirring, and a laminated ID badge soon appeared. Here is your new badge. Take your belongings and report to Building B at the Hayward Executive Airport. There, they will assign you to your new unit. He handed Frank his badge and some paperwork. Next. Frank was stunned. Drafted? How is that even possible? At his age? There must be some way to appeal this. He walked slowly away from the intake facility, trying to get his bearings. He suddenly thought of his mother alone on Marlin Street. Who would live with her now? His sister Linda and her partner Rhonda lived a mile away and were in and out regularly. His son and Janet and other grandkids were nearby and visited a lot, too. And there was a state-provided nurse who came over every other day to help bathe his mother and check her vitals. But he felt bad about it. She was 100 years old. He should stay with her till the end. Maybe he could get a special release. Who to talk to? He drove from Southland the short distance into the airport, waving his badge under the handheld scanner of the soldier at the security gate. He went to the Building B main desk, where he explained about his centenarian mother and his own age and tried to get someone to release him from the draft. But the clerks were young soldiers who knew nothing. They were not able to help and didn't think there was anyone who could affect a change in Frank's status. Once you were drafted and at Building B, you were in. Frank stepped outside, completely exasperated. He called his sister Linda, who picked up right away. Linda, It's hard to believe, but I've been drafted. What? What do you mean? And he explained the Kafkaesque hour and a half he'd spent since arriving in Hayward. They actually expect me to live in a barracks, and they say I'm stuck for 6 months at least and maybe 2 years. But they can't do that. You're too old. And what about moms? What do they say about that? Nothing. It's completely bureaucratic. It's the fucking military. Nobody here can do anything, or so they say. It's unbelievable. Frank felt like he was exploding. Not good for the blood pressure or the heart, he thought. Hey, soldier, what are you doing? Barked the security guard. No loitering out here. Get to your assigned barracks. Linda, I gotta go. I'll call you later, but make sure you guys figure out a schedule with moms, okay? I won't be back for a while. And he hung up.
Wow. So for our listeners' benefit, Frank is really the central character, I would say. And he's so interestingly delineated because you say, you were just reading, he's been drafted, fuck. Even worse, he gets promoted. He's promoted because they want a front man, they want a person of color fronting, and they want a native San Franciscan. He becomes the informant, much to his chagrin, and he's constantly toggling between how much information to give and not to give, what will benefit the people and protect the people versus what will endanger them. So he's working out this historical process as he's subjected to it at the same time. And I love the description of the family because it's exactly that, his mother and then his children and their children, and a sense of commitment to the community, which might be his downfall. He survives. I don't want to give up with the entire plot, but he's a beautifully delineated character and we follow his moral choices throughout. Yeah.
And I think you're right. Although I think you've given a little more credit than I did as I was writing him, because I wanted him to be basically a go-along, get-along cop act. So he can't just go along, get along, period, because he's got to compromise, he's got to deal with the conflicts that he's going to run into as a black man. And so that gets him a little bit on the liberal end of the spectrum, a little bit more thoughtful, a little bit more alterity in his worldview than he might have otherwise. But he's essentially a conformist who's taken the easy path at every turn. And he's not happy about anything that he's having to do. He wants an easy way out, and there's really not one presenting itself. And then when they later promote him, he's very confused by it. And he doesn't at first understand that the way they're using him. It takes his sisters reading him the Riot Act at a certain point to really wake him up to the fact that he's just a pawn in their system. But he's never really a strong defender of the community. Really not. He's inadvertently trying to help his family at certain key moments. And they use him as best they can to get something out of him.
Right.
But he's not thinking, oh, I've got to help San Franciscans survive this onslaught. Really, he's just trying to do his best to make it less awful for him and everybody who's near him. So I find him to be an interesting character because he, to me, captures something of what most people are like. And their attempts to cope with a world that they don't have any control over and any real say over the terms of the moral quandaries they're faced with. I'm just going to do the best I can here. Might end up from the outside looking like I'm an asshole or I'm doing something really morally compromised, but it's the best I can do under the circumstances. And who am I? What can I do? That's everybody's state. And the other key role that I wanted him for, and the reason I really start the book through his eyes in a way, is I actually feel when we think about anything that we might use the term revolution ambitiously to describe, you really can't have one anymore unless the people who have the guns and the official status of the troops of repression turn. They have to be subverted somehow. And so I think a certain number of radicals tend to forget this and find it very easy to just demonize everybody who wears a uniform or works for the state. And I understand that. I've done it myself. But I hate to say it, but I don't think we can win on strictly doing an uprising against the guns. Like they just kill everybody. And so you need people with the guns to turn the guns either on themselves or on their co-repressors. At some point, they have to factionalize, they have to split, they have to become demoralized, they have to not believe in what they're doing. And until that moment, we don't have a very good chance. But once that starts happening, then everything opens up and everything's possible. So that was one of the subplots of the book, is to show Frank as a way inside the police, which I've never been a cop. I don't know the first thing about what it's actually like to go to their daily meetings or the military for that matter. But using my fertile imagination, I tried to try to put myself in that role and see what would happen if I faced this and I faced that. That's a lot of writing fiction for me. I don't know if it's like that for everybody, but for me, it's, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know where the story's going. I'm just sitting out at the keyboard and starting to type, and I'm putting myself in the predicament of, okay, today I'm writing from Frank's point of view, I'm writing from Janice, I'm writing from this other person's point of view. And then what happens in front of me? Who do I meet? What are the interactions that come up? And I have ideas about where I want things to go vaguely, but the very specific evolution of the plot and the interaction between people comes because I'm actually in the room with them and they're saying those things. And I didn't know they were going to say them until they said them. And now they're saying them and it's, oh, okay. Yeah, of course. And then that other person enters the room. I didn't even know they were in the book. And now they're a character who's insisting on being in my book. How did you get here? I'm stuck with you. Oh my God. That happened a lot in this book.
When you were talking about guns, you know, I have to agree with you. And I was just thinking about the reports from Palestine and the heavy number of IOF soldiers committing suicide. There's something going on in that respect. And you're right. I've probably sentimentalized Frank in the months since I finished the book. So thank you for that corrective. So turning to a more positive set of characters, tell us about the plumbers.
Yeah, that was one of those kind of, I didn't know I was going to do that. Again, it just stumbled into it by accident. But there's a guy who starts out in the early part of the book being the sort of hippie-ish young volunteer at one of the community gardens. And he's a kind of white hippie-ish guy. And you meet him at first there. And then the next time you see him, he's actually being held at Hayward Executive Airport as another prisoner who gets taken away. And then in the wake of all that, those interactions, he becomes a plumber. He's encouraged by Janet, who's the niece of Frank and is a big organizer with the League of Urban Farmers. And she's a big farmer at Alamany Farm and runs several other gardens out in the Baby Hunters Point and Churro Hill areas, including one that I called the Dog Patch, which is just funny because there is a neighborhood that we refer to as Dog Patch. But the Dog Patch is along the southern shore of Islas Creek, where today is, there are people out there fishing regularly, and it's a somewhat abandoned, not quite abandoned, Pier 94 area. And so I turned that into a giant urban farm in the book, and that becomes a site of many interesting things that happen there in Islas Creek. But Jay, our former erstwhile urban farmer, he's encouraged by Janet, why don't you go look at the plumbers? I hear they've got some openings. You can get a job with the plumbers union. That would be a really important thing to change the politics of that. And that's a little bit of a backhanded slight on the Plumbers Union, which is famously one of the most right-wing unions in San Francisco. And actually, not only right-wing, but super racist in their history. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't even let Chinese join the union until late 1960s. They were so racist. And so they remain a very, as many of the building trades do, a really reactionary force and urban politics who just want to pour cement wherever they can. If you go back to the freeway revolt in the 60s, you know, that was led by essentially housewives who at that point were still able to live on the single wage logic of the nuclear family of the 1950s, who were in the parks and in the zones of the city that suddenly were being targeted by engineers to put freeways through it. But who was pro-freeway? When they had the big vote and it went 5-5, five votes against it, and Terry Francois, the first Black supervisor to cast the vote in the Board of Supervisors to not allow the Golden Gate Park Panhandle Freeway to be built. And it was shocking news, headline news across the United States that San Franciscans had said no to building a freeway. What's going on? But who was for it? In that moment, it was the trade unions and the so-called left of the Board of Supervisors and the pro-labor mayor, Jack Shelley. They were all for it because all they want to do is pour cement. Yeah. They'll build, and they don't care about anything else. It's just give me a job with a high wage and shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
So that kind of attitude is what needs to change from a long arc of politics that we're just really just getting going with. And if you go back to Seattle 25 years ago and Teamsters and Turtles finally found a way to get together. That didn't last very long. You still have this endless ability by the right and by the corporate America to drive a wedge between anybody who cares about what do we do and why are we destroying the planet? Mm-hmm. And then people who say, oh, what are you, anti-jobs? Yes,
exactly.
Let me tell you right now, I am anti-jobs.
The jobs that they're talking about, right?
Jobs are the problem. Yeah. The organization of life through wage labor is the problem. You're never going to solve it by asking for, please give me better work. Please let me do nice things. That's not going to do anything. That's just like laughably naive. So the trade union movement then in the book, back to the book, you see it through the plumbers union. And so I create a whole situation where there's a young radical movement inside the plumbers union who takes over the union through rank and file revolt, which that has happened many times in San Francisco unions as well as more national unions. And once they take it over, they don't fully take it over, right? It's never completely done. So you still have the other types of folks in the old guard who hold some mm-hmm. of the executive board seats and are not happy that these young guys want to talk about water politics or environmentalism or changing how we deal with sewage or any of these kind of things. They just want to hear about it. They just want a job. Well, just do your job, man. And so that's a real split. That's not going away anytime soon. So that exists in the book as well. But the young plumbers are clearly capable of thinking of a more radical agenda. And they actually, some of them end up becoming muscle, if you will, for mm-hmm. this movements that are on the ground in the city, which are largely people dealing with urban agriculture and the defending the so-called urban peasants, who are the ones who've been thrown out of Biogenmo and are left homeless and wondering what to do and how to take care of themselves. And they're very practical because many of them are actually immigrants from Central and South America or Mexico, and they understand they got this short-term deal, but now they're left mm-hmm. wondering what to do next. And so they organize towards integrating with the farming movement and urban farming and agriculture in general. So a path that I think we'll inevitably have to take up in a much more serious way as human beings, because first of all, again, bringing in the history hat for a moment, it's worth remembering that at the end of World War II, 45% of all the fresh vegetables and fruits of the United States was grown in city gardens. 45%. And obviously the population is much smaller then, and the amount of food grown is much smaller. But today it's less than 3%, and it could easily be somewhere between those two numbers, approaching a third of all of our fresh produce could be coming out of city gardens if we mm-hmm. so chose to use our land that way. Right now we choose to use our land by covering 50% of every city in asphalt for the maintenance of parking for private automobiles and the movement of some vehicles sometimes. It's like, use of land? So my favorite slogan is always one lane for food, which I snuck that into the novel too. So that's a rallying cry for the League of Urban Farmers. One lane for food. Dig up a half of every street and turn it into linear farms.
But after the Great Flood, if you will, as I recall, it's the radical plumbers who come up with a solution of how to basically rectify this huge catastrophe, right?
Yeah, it's not quite a solution, but it's a theory of how they might solve some of the problems.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit late in the book, and this is a little bit of a spoiler alert moment. So I'm just going to say spoiler alert. So if you don't want to know more details about what happens later in the book, close your ears for a while. But there is a big earthquake that happens, the big quake on Christmas Eve in 2026. And it leads to the destruction of a lot of the plumbing, of course, and a lot of the literal shit in the city that depends on that plumbing ends up forming a new lagoon where there has been historically a tidal lagoon. Of course, the oceans have come up, so there's a lot of pressure from groundwater rising in addition to tidal influxes through king tides and others. And I've calculated where all the king tides are. Like, actually, the book is very accurate mm-hmm, about mm-hmm. how king tides are going to hit for the next 3 years. And the plumbers realize that there's this massive shit lake covering a good part of the North Mission today, where Rainbow Grocery is, and all those, the area that got really flooded just a year ago, January, where the water was up to the windows on cars right under the freeway there, right across from Rainbow Grocery on Division Street. So that's now permanent. Like, we're stuck with it. This is morass of sewage and dirty water and garbage, and there's no way to drain it. And there's no way. These things still are coming in from various broken plumbing systems throughout this particular corner of the city. And so the plumbers are looking at them, and it smells really bad. It's a huge health crisis. It's January of 2027. What are we going to do? And they realize that there's prognostications of rain as well as high tides coming at the same time. So they rush to help get crews of volunteers to clear the way for the waters to come tumbling down the city's hills and flood and push out as much of this into the bay during the high tide as possible. And that's a little bit of thinking about the hydrology of the city in a mm-hmm. way that plumbers generally haven't been, but these radical plumbers do.
And a lot of the book does work on the idea of sometimes it takes something catastrophic for us to really reboot and reset things and set on another path. I want to get to the witch's butter, because that is, if you will pardon me, the glue of the book in some ways. I wonder if you have a passage about witch's butter. Yeah.
The next one.
Wonderful.
This is pretty short, but basically just to say quickly that witch's butter is a real fungus. You can find it in the Tilden Park and various other places around the Bay Area during wet periods. It's a beautiful little yellow ball. It looks like a little cluster of yellow little nodules. And then when it dries out, it's like black and crusty and ugly. So I was hunting for a fungus. I should pause briefly just to say that, and you said something nice about this already. I really wanted nature to have its own voice, its own role to play as an agent of history, not just like the background or something that's the context or quote unquote the environment, but actually something that takes a role actively in trying to shape the course of history. And I believe that's actually going to happen or is happening all the time and is going to be more profound as we go along, as we become better to understand it. I just read a book by this woman, Karen Backer, called Gaia's Web. And she does a pretty good job of describing all these ways that we want to monitor the earth and do digital governance on a global scale. But she's also quite clear that most of this would be used against that goal by the existing power structure. And so if we don't radically change how we organize our lives, this whole idea of using technology for good like this is stupid. But so there's this kind of way that we want to, but she has a previous book called The Sounds of Nature. And then along with Ed Yong's great work on this various types of understanding the intelligence of nature and other books by Franz Wahl and other people, we have so underestimated how intelligent the world is around us. And we've the sort of history of animistic religions of really understanding us as part of a web of life, and that this is our kin, native, typically indigenous sensibilities about where we are in the world. I feel like that's the real world that modern life and Christianity has done so much to eliminate, trying to make us oblivious to. And for most people stuck staring into their screens all day, that they are oblivious to it. But in this novel is my chance to like connect to that sensibility and try to find a way to bring it into the conversation, at least it's the story. So I did it, and I didn't know how I was going to do it. I just knew I wanted nature to have a voice. And I start writing, and I get this kind of crazy biotech idea, like there's this fungus that's on the main scientist's mind as one of these ideas she has that she brings with her to this big company when she gets bought out. She's in a startup called Hemp Battery, because she's invented the hemp battery. And she brings this thing, and it's on the back burner in the biotech company, the Biogenmo, and then some unknown parties of workers organizing inside of that company smuggle it out. Smuggle the idea because it's not being developed. Typically, corporations take over ideas and they don't develop them because they're not immediately profitable. They don't care. So if somebody smuggles it out, goes to a biohacker lab in the South of Market run by a guy who's originally of Vietnamese descent, but he's been in San Francisco most of his life, named Dap Doan, and he's now in his late 50s, and he's running this hacker lab where all these people are just having fun messing around with stuff. And a lot of it's about adding genes and subtracting them and manipulating them and using CRISPR and all the stuff that's out there. It's basically anybody in their house can set up a lab now. So let's have fun in the story and see what happens. So they get a hold of this idea that is the way it first emerges, as taking witch's butter as a good candidate for becoming a malleable fungus that could be used as a building material. That's the commercial idea behind it. And they take it and they start adding stuff to it. And we don't know what till much later in the book. And I don't want to spoil that for you. But they create this vat of essentially gray, putty-ish thing. And you don't really know I didn't even know when I invented it, what it was going to be. But it starts to take on a life of its own. Here we go. Janet, who I introduced, Janet Pierce, the niece of Frank, and Dad, the guy I just mentioned, said they heard crows speak one day. This happened earlier in the book already. It was connected to the putty-like fungus they'd grown, but then it never happened again. Vero's snacks and dishes became the talk of the staff at Larry's and Leon's and local farms, where it was being shared widely. Her recipes for the chips, this was made out of this stuff, this putty, this fungus. Her recipes for the chips, as well as pasta and fresh cheese derived from the witch's butter, were very popular. And batches of witch's butter were being nurtured in a half dozen locations now. In the secret cellar kitchen a few days ago, Vera was busy baking when Maria came in. "Here, try this." And she thrust a large wooden spoon of warm dough to Maria, who gladly ate it without hesitation. "What is it?" "The latest. We can make cookies out of witch's butter, too." Vera looked happy. Since she'd been stuck in hiding, she needed a way to contribute, and she'd found it. "The witch's butter grows back as fast as I can use it. I've never seen anything like it. If I take a pound or two to try different things, and then I return a few hours later, the place where I took some has already grown back." "Wow, that's unusual." Maria was chewing happily on her dough sample. "Dad says they can't decide what the nutritional properties are. Every experiment they've run on raw witch's butter indicates that it has some basic vitamins, A, D, even some C. There's a decent amount of protein, too, but when I had him run tests on the chips or the pasta, the results were completely different. there were huge increases in protein and basic elements like zinc, manganese, and iron appeared too. We can't explain it, but it's like a superfood, especially after I cook it. When you're cooking, do you do a lot of tasting? Do you put the stuff in your mouth and then it goes back to the batch you're working on? Asked Maria, suddenly curious. Huh? What do you mean? I don't put it in my mouth and then spit it back into the pot, if that's what you mean. But I eat from the spoon that I use to stir things. I suppose my saliva might have mixed with what I was cooking, though only in tiny amounts. We should try some more experiments. What happens if we introduce human fluids to batches of witch's butter isolated from the cooking process? And what happens if the same batch is cooked? And of course, what happens if we cook with some without it, having ever known any human sweat or saliva or even skin? But the witch's butter was created in part by the massaging and chanting we did last year. We brought it from a vat of gray clay to that cream-colored putty. When Dad put IntelliGel in that one batch, it turned bright canary yellow, remember? The original witch's butter became very familiar with our skin, our sweat, and even probably some aerosolized saliva and possibly other fluids like a drip from someone's nose. Who knows? We weren't being careful and had no reason to assume there was any reason to take precautions, Vero explained. Maria was pondering this when she had an aha moment. What if the witch's butter is adapting to human physiology by becoming more nutritious for us when we use it? Is that possible? Asked Vero, knowing she had no scientific understanding. How would it do that? How does that even work?
Now, it's such... Tell me more about how you came up, because it becomes a nexus for all these different characters wondering what this is, what to do with it. And what I love, one of the most powerful moments in the book is when some people begin to be a little bit suspicious about how you're monkeying around with this stuff. Can you make it create light and energy? And all? It sounds wonderful, but isn't that kind of perverting its original nature? And the whole question of what nature is and how we live with it or in it or through it. Could you talk more about it? Because it's such a rich metaphor, I think.
Yeah, one idea I had, that little passage alludes to it, where it replaces itself almost as fast as you can eat it, was I was reminded, I'm actually, by marriage to the mother of my daughter many years ago, we weren't married, but we were together for a long time. Her grandfather was Al Capp, the cartoonist who did Little Abner.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And in Little Abner, you might remember the Shmoo. And
yeah.
So the Shmoo was on my mind as I started thinking about witch's butter as an edible item. I was like, oh yeah, it'll be like a Shmoo. It'd be, you cannot eat it up. It just keeps reproducing itself as fast as you eat it. And the more you eat it, the more it reproduces.
Oh, it's, yeah, it's perfect.
Because it's a metaphor for generalized abundance, right? And that's what we all dream should be possible on the planet that we live on, which is so beautiful and abundant. And we treat it like a source of nothing but scarcity.
Wasn't he the guy who had a job testing mattresses?
Little Abner, yeah, that was his job, full-time job.
Perfect.
Of course, the Beverly Hillbillies was stolen from the comic strip. They had a family lawsuit against the company that the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, yeah.
They lost, but so it goes. Anyhow, so that was one idea about it. And then I started more and more thinking about this, just like trying to think creatively about it as best I could. And I'm not a real scientist, as you can tell. I'm just not. And I tried to get biologists to read my early draft. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever responded that I gave it to. They just didn't have time to look at it. It's too big. That's an embarrassing thing to ask people to read a book that's 250,000 words. But I just decided to run with it anyway. And then I came upon some other work from a friend of mine who's been working with this stuff. This guy, Ilya Prigogine, and various people who think about how systems of less complexity become more complex. They actually can assemble themselves into more complexity over time. There's a whole thread of advanced thinking going on around this stuff that's way beyond my pay grade or my ken. I don't know this stuff very well, but I did do a brief deep dive into it as I was writing the novel because I was like, wow, this is perfect. Mm-hmm. So I purloined some of those concepts and it helped me think about how this is not such a far-fetched idea, that something could emerge. In my case, I made it emerge through accidental genetic manipulation, and then it becomes a life form of its own and begins assembling its own direction mm-hmm. and going in its own way. And it actually, in some moment in the book, there's a point where I'm having this view from on high above the whole earth, where the atmosphere, I don't know if you're familiar with the work of David Abram, who wrote The Spell of the Sensuous and Becoming Animal, two really highly recommended books for if you want to get inside of the sense of animism as a living force in the world. He's probably one of the most poetically beautiful writers on that, and a very scientifically grounded guy and a magician. A lot of really interesting stuff in his books. But I decided that, yeah, I'm going to take one of his things that he really impressed upon me, which is to think about the atmosphere of the earth as this one thing that we are all knit together by. I'm constantly having it inside of me. You have it inside of you. Every single leaf of every single tree is sharing this with us and passing it back and forth. Every animal, everything that's here is doing that. And if you start looking at it that way, you want an integrative view of life. It's a much bigger thing than our corporeal entities, which are already not, we get so individualistic, and yet we're comprised of dozens and dozens of species who live inside of us, where our moods are absolutely altered by them, our intelligence is shaped by them, blah, 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 it goes on and on. So I had a moment where the atmosphere is noticing that there's this new life form appearing in San Francisco. I won't say how that gets described, but you can read the book for that. But I do have a moment where it's, oh, this guy, whatever you want to call it, the totality of life on Earth, as Earth, recognizes that something new is happening in San Francisco, which is this strangely mutated form of a fungus. And the fungus then does go back to being a building material also. It's part of what happens essentially a squatter community in San Bruno Mountain, which I've always felt close to because I had a lot of time. I have a good friend, David Schooley, over there, who's the guru of the mountain. And there's all these amazing things about that ecologically, where it's one of the original, it's the last remnant of the real eco niche that was once the whole mother. And there's an Indian Shell Mountain there. And there's these amazing canyons with old, very old oak forests in them. And a lot of stuff. So anyway, I have a squatter community develop over there that has the witch's butter actually grows them homes. And I just have fun with that, right? And I let it do a lot of different things. It's become this sort of source of food during growing problems with feeding people during this harsh military regime. And then it also becomes a communication system where people begin to communicate with other species. They don't quite know they are. Like I tried to make it happen. You're in a little boat and the seals come up and they start barking at you, but you don't know why. One of the characters, this Maria scientist woman, she's out on a little boat and she's, what's going on? They come right up to her and they want to talk to her, right? Because they can feel somehow that there's an open channel of communication, even if she can't fully understand anything they're saying or understand what the point of it all is. She starts to recognize something is afoot, something's happening here. And so I feel like that's maybe how this would go if we really were going through this kind of a moment. I've had friends sending me pictures of the witches' butters.
Yeah.
The book. Because what I wanted to say is that it becomes a voice of nature, a way that nature begins to intervene.
Exactly.
Not just human society, but the society of life, all of us in different life forms. And it begins to help us find ways to be able to talk to each other in some curious, unexpected way.
Exactly. And the episode where it first hit me was, I think it's the crows that are warning people of the approaching danger of the army or the cops or something like that. So it becomes a sort of a life force against the non-life force, the anti-life force.
Yeah.
Really beautifully.
I can imagine people scoffing at that as easily as enjoying it. So it's always one of those things, right? A little bit of cringe factor myself, because I'm not a woo-woo guy at all. Hilariously not. And yet, the world gods will love this.
But I'm thinking, I immediately thought about fungi in the forest, about how they telegraph when there's a toxin in the earth, it will spread it out to other trees, etc.
Yeah, yeah.
No, it's not far-fetched at all.
Yeah, the mother tree stuff and Suzanne Simard and the Richard Powers Overstory novel, all that gets to that quite well. And the wood wide web, as some people have referred to it, yeah, which has got some scientists debunking it completely. It's an argument that's out there. It's fine. I don't discount at all that there's a great deal of communication going on in nature amongst quite a lot of different species. There's somebody, I just read a piece where in that Gaia's Web, where she talks about the honeybee. There's scientists who have decided that honeybee hives make democratic decisions together about where to move. And they can trace it electrically through those pulses between the different bees
communicating
with each other in a debate. And slowly but surely, a debate settles on a location. And then they all go to that location. And actually, the pattern is very close to how neurons firing in our brains is. That's pretty fascinating to imagine, whether that's what it really is. Much science to be done, much debate. But people who are inclined towards a Cartesian view of we're the only things with intelligence and ability to communicate, everything else is just dumb matter. It's just a little false. And,
exactly.
Nobody can really hold on to that credibly anymore. And so if that's true, then it begs lots of questions. There's obviously the animal rights movement's been quite strong for a long time, and I've never really partook in that very much. But I also recognize that if you're going to take it really consistently, then what about plants' rights movements? Because they scream too.
Did you get a chance to listen to the episode we did with Paco Calvo?
No, I will.
When we log off. So we had him in a conversation. He wrote the book Planta Sapiens. So we had him in conversation with John Burroughs, who's an indigenous legal scholar in Canada. I think you'd really enjoy that conversation.
Check it out. That sounds right up my alley.
Yeah. But you mentioned Richard Powers, and in some ways, it brings us back to something I remarked on at the beginning of our conversation, which is when I read the Overstory, and when I teach it especially, I tell my students, he's talking about Earth First. He's talking about the first wave of activism for the environment. And it's both its beauty and its failures. And in some ways, I think your novel does a similar service of paying respect to and appreciating those early instantiations of understanding what was happening with the Earth, but also showing some of the ways it fell short, but giving us hope that we could regenerate certain things if we are smart and if we open our minds to new knowledges, largely coming from indigenous communities and epistemologies, but other sources as well. I just wanted to put you up in league with Richard Powers and the Overstory.
Very flattering.
But I really wanted to thank you so much for this novel and tell people you have to read it. But one thing I wanted to ask you about before I let you go is and I told you this when we started communicating about this interview, how would you put it in conversation with Nowtopia, which is a great book?
I appreciate that.
Talk a bit about that.
Yeah. I'll just give a brief overview of Nowtopia so that people have a sense of it. It was published in 2008, and it was a logical outgrowth of my many years doing Processed World, which was 1981 to 94. And then we did a couple more in the beginning of the 2000s just for fun. Processed World was about the underside of the information age as told by the alienated wage slaves of the modern office and beyond. And it was full of humor and poetry and satire and political analysis and fake ads and all sorts of great stuff. So if you don't, Processed World online, you can see the whole thing at the Internet Archive. Go to archive.org and search for Processed World magazine or collective, and you'll find them all. Nowtopia, the subtitle is How Pirate Programmers, Outlaw Bicyclists, and Vacant Lot Gardeners are Inventing the Future Today. And right there in the title, you can see that it overlaps with the novel because some of those characters who I saw as agents of history for the nonfiction treatment appear in this book as actual actors, even though it's a little hard to find them in my real life anymore, which is one of my frustrations. But Nowtopia is essentially about how people take their time and their technological know-how out of the market. And when they're not at their idiotic jobs trying to make a living for money, they work really hard trying to address the actual problems in our lives, whether it's the ecological crisis or the crisis of social anomie or the emptiness of everyday life, whatever you want to call it. That's what people are up against in their real lives. And then in so doing, it's not just a hobby a lot of the time. It's actually what makes their life worth living, like the same way playing music does to a musician. Like when you're a person who has a job as a programmer or some office person or lawyer even or whatever, and then in your free time, quote unquote, is when you feel alive, you're really doing what matters to you. That's a pretty vital reality that we have done a poor job of theorizing as a society especially amongst people with radical politics, because we get hung up on the idea that it's the working class movement that has to change the world through organizing in the factories and the offices and the loading docks and the schools. And oh, sure, of course, that needs to happen too. But where is it that people feel passionate? What makes them move? What makes them excited to be alive as human beings? It's not being a worker, precisely not being a worker. And there are theoreticians about this. John Holloway is a great theoretician on this very topic. Parallel has a book called Crack Capitalism, which I think is a very parallel to Nowtopia, and we're good pals. So there's this idea that the radical political moment is to escape the categories of capital, to escape being merely a worker and becoming a fully human person engaged in changing the world through the activity you carry out, which we generally refer to as work. And a lot of it does feel like work a lot of the time. And then the contradictions for all these projects, whether they're creating a DIY bike kitchen, putting a lot of energy into being in the community garden, and you find the people on either side of you. One of them came from the South, a Black person from the Deep South who knows all about collard greens and black-eyed peas and things you never heard of. And the person on the other side of you is from Cambodia or El Salvador, and they brought all these vegetables and fruits you've never heard of, and they're growing their stuff, and you're becoming friends, and you're having these conversations. And in that case, and similarly in a DIY bike kitchen, you might find yourself with some 10-year-olds and a guy, old geezer like me, old white guy, and then I'm talking to these kids who are Black. But what do I know? And then suddenly we have something in common. We want to go on a ride together through the city, and we're creating relationships. And those relationships are exactly what we've lost for the last half century. That's what capitalism is so good at, is dissolving human relationships and turning us all into isolated individuals. And so that atomization and fragmentation that we've lived through, the antidote to it is essentially what I, you know, and from an Italian autonomous Marxist point of view, is the recomposition of the working class.
Exactly.
That is, all of us who produce the world are the working class. I mean, whether you make a ton of money for Google or you make almost nothing, you know, doing back kitchen work here in San Francisco, we have to sell ourselves to a job to survive. That means you're in a proletarian. You're in the working class. The wage level is irrelevant. It's not about how much you make. It's what the relationship is to power over how we produce life. And most of us are busily producing a life that we don't agree with in so many ways. And we don't even bother to ask ourselves how many ways we don't agree with the world we're forced to live in, because there's no mechanism for that. There's no democracy about what we do and how we do it and why. And the fundamental question is, why are we here? What are we up to? What's the point of all this? And so when people are doing stuff in their free time, they are recreating a different logic. They're creating new relationships and new ways of addressing the predicament in the world. And the bigger, deeper issues in that, of course, again, from a somewhat Marxian point of view, is this notion of the general intellect. And so that got a lot of play for a while back there, several decades ago. And now it comes up over and over again since then. And the idea of the general intellect is that it's everything of the apparatus of life. You know, that is to say, all the human labor that preceded us built this world. Mm. And much of that world we can't understand or grasp at all. And yet we're able to interact with it because of our ability to be part of the general intellect. We know what to do with a cell phone. We know what to do with getting the TV to work. We know how to take a bus, ride the BART, drive a car. All of these things are part of what is the ongoing reproduction of an apparatus. And the apparatus is the embodiment of a lot of dead labor, people who came before us who did all this stuff. And sometimes there's moments where we might contest the direction of the general intellect. That is to say that we don't like where it's going. So good examples that I like to quote, and I did in Nowtopia, and this book, the novel, is trying to lay this out much more intensively. In Nowtopia, I talked about the fact that today healthcare, for all of its horrible, disastrous, bad organization and profiteering and misery, nevertheless, is radically better and different than it was in 1965. And one of the major reasons for that is the second wave feminism, where women got together in small groups and started talking about their feelings and their health, their physical health. And at that point, men in white lab coats had very little understanding of women's physiology, it turns out. They knew some of the most basic things, but they really didn't have any deep knowledge of women's physiology. And women began appropriating that knowledge for themselves by self-examinations and communication.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a radical movement that changed healthcare across the board. And as it turns out, it dovetailed with movements to creating multilingual healthcare and all kinds of other things like that. So today, the fact that you can get acupuncture or Ayurveda medicine or homeopathy or whatever, you would not have been able to get that stuff easily in the 1960s. Now it's like everybody and their grandmother has access to every quack possible thing out there, better for better and for worse, frankly, but there it is. That's a product of a movement from below contesting the direction of science and technology and medical care. Another great example that's forgotten and now we have to reinvent it is the anti-nuclear movement. Mm-hmm. We basically brought the nuclear power movement to a halt in the 1970s, because it was such a stupid way to boil water. It still is. And the idea that it's a solution for climate change and global warming is ridiculous. It's sickeningly ridiculous to hear people talk about it that way. It just drives me bonkers, this eco-modernist agenda of more and more of the awfulest stuff in order to solve one tiny narrow problem that we can identify. So no, you're just like delusional. The anti-nuclear movement was a great example of people who didn't have any right to invade that space at all, who weren't scientists, they weren't government officials, they weren't running the big companies, and yet we organized on the ground, millions of us, most of us in under 30 at the time, and really had a major impact and changed the direction of energy production and science. And that was pro-solar back then. I remember 1970s, like, oh, if everybody had solar energy, we'd have the revolution. And then in the 1990s, I helped start critical mass. And it was like, if everybody rides a bicycle, we'll have a revolution.
Yeah.
But I didn't buy either of those at the time. In both cases, that was wrong. But it does have an impact. Even the bicycling movement really has helped make urban life somewhat better than it would have been otherwise. Every bike is not a car, as we like to say, one less car, and that's a little less carbon going into the atmosphere. Every single person who's chosen to ride a bicycle is a way to get around. Is a little tiny step in the right direction. It's not the answer. You can't solve it through consumer choices. You can buy all the light bulbs you want. It won't make any difference at all. You could never ride a plane again, and the planes are going to still go. So we have to have a more higher level of aggregate choices around the division of labor, the technologies we might use. And that's what I was trying to really illustrate, is that these kind of grassroots movements are part of that process of saying that we actually have a right to democratically control the direction of science and technology.
Yeah.
And in the novel, I said, let's say that's even further advanced in terms of social actors and social movements, and let's see what they come up with.
This has been such a wonderful opportunity to share ideas and learn from you, Chris. And I have many plots boiling my brain. I want you to, you know, come down and address my students. Here we are in the belly of the beast, and it's strangling the minds of so many people who intuit a much broader world. It's exactly as you say, when they're not working, they go out and they do things and it just gives them life. And they say, why are the proportions so skewed in the wrong direction? We'll have many more conversations. This has been a great start. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's a great pleasure. I look forward to checking out some of the back issues that I haven't checked out yet. So I'll be exploring all the way. I've heard a few of your shows and they're all great. And I really, again, want to appreciate the fact that you've been dogged in your work on Gaza. Like, very few people could keep that level of engagement and commitment up through the incredibly hard times that we've watched go on there. And just to stay on it day in and day out for so long, kudos to you for that.
Take care. Have a good day.
Yeah,
bye-bye.
Bye, David.
Please take a moment to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. This will help bring it to other people's intentions. You might also follow me on Twitter at Palumbo Liu and let us know about any subjects you would like us to cover or people or groups you'd like us to interview.